Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Howard Morgan. Howard is not only the chairman of the B Capital Group, but one of the NVCA's recent Vanguard Award winners. Howard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Christian.
So let's start with B Capital Group. We'd love to learn more about the firm and its investment focus.
B Capital Group is a multi-stage venture firm running from seed stage through venture growth. We have about $8 billion under management in total. Right now, investing out of two funds mainly, the early stage fund called Ascent, and that fund's about a $400 million fund, and the growth fund, which is about a $2.1 billion fund. We invest globally, so offices in the US, but also all over Southeast Asia, Singapore headquarters, Indonesia, Bangalore, Delhi, Mumbai, a little bit of presence left in China, Hong Kong and Beijing, but not doing new investing in China right now, geopolitics being what it is. And we're partnered with the Boston Consulting Group, with BCG, which provides really real help to our companies, to our portfolio companies. And that's been a relationships that started when the firm did about 2015 with my co-founders, Eduardo Saverin, who is the co-founder of Facebook, Meta now, and Raj Ganguly, who had started Bain Capital Asia. And the three of us wanted to create something that would invest initially later stage, B stage and later, mostly focused on B2B and focused on the digitization going on around the world, particularly in India and Southeast Asia, but also in the US. About 75% of our dollars are invested in the US, North America really, and 25% are invested overseas, mostly mostly in India. We're starting to invest now in the Gulf, and we do invest a little bit in Israel and a little bit in Latin America, but pretty broad. But high tech, about 25% healthcare, about 50% sort of traditional enterprise software of various kinds, and about 25% frontier tech, deep tech, whatever you want to call it, space technology, brain computer interfaces, humanoid robots, and stuff like that. And about 100 people, about 100 people across the firm.
Really impressive. So if we could start unpacking B Capital a little bit, what's the degree that the firm's partners will get involved with supporting founders?
Well, that's a key. I mean, one of our distinctions is that we provide tremendous support to founders, both through the initial, through the partners themselves, of course, but also through our relationship with BCG. Every growth stage company gets a BCG, I think they call it MDP, a managing director or partner, kind of as a board observer who meets with the CEOs once a week, once a month, and provides advice. We can ask BCG for due diligence help, which they give us. They do webinars for our companies. Our early stage companies will get a webinar on sales pricing, marketing, you name it. BCG has some amazing experts around the world. And BCG does not own any of the firm. They don't make any of the investment decisions, but they do earn a piece of the carry interest in return for providing the various services they provide.
Wow. So, I mean, to a sense, I mean, you can almost argue it's like a proxy CVC that you're able to tap that expertise and knowledge. And so really helpful, you know, so would love to know, so I heard B2B, I heard the different industries that you focus on, you know, big topic that keeps, you can imagine, reoccurring on the podcast is the role of artificial intelligence and how the impact it's having on pure software valuations, the role that it has in bringing companies to life, and that founders are perhaps holding off on raising capital because they can do more with less. What's your and B Capital Group's
Well, first, clearly AI is changing the world. There's no question that since the the ChatGPT launch a couple of years ago, the world has realized that AI is for everybody now. It's not just for machine learning. It's not just for figuring out how to do speech or how to do image recognition. It really is pretty much broadly used. So we kind of, there's no company that we invest in today that doesn't have to tell us how they're using AI, unless they are a company that's focused on AI itself. For example, we're investors in Perplexity. That's AI in search, quite different. We're investors in Lambda Labs, which provides access to the big NVIDIA chips to many companies. And we're investors in lots of other companies, particularly AI in healthcare, which is explosive. And not only explosive, but we're finding that AI in radiology does better than the radiologists themselves, certainly better specifically when they assist radiologists, but even just by them by itself. AI in diagnosis, AI in robotic surgery, obviously in drug discovery and pharma, we have a number of investments. So AI is a key piece of everything we do. I don't think there's a company that's not using it somewhere, whether it's customer service and using chatbots for support. So yes, we are seeing people do more with less. And as you mentioned, to some extent, the valuations are starting to get into bubbly territory, particularly in the Bay Area, but not necessarily elsewhere. And I think that's critical. We're also big investors in embodied AI, robotics of various kinds. And we think that's an important part of the future.
I'm curious, so you mentioned valuations in the Bay Area, and today you have a whole host of firms that will specifically invest outside of Silicon Valley for that reason. Do you find that the group will be willing to pay up if you really like the founder and the company, or do you find that the firm will be more conservative at times?
Well, first of all, in 2012, 80% of the unicorns came out of Silicon Valley. By 2020, that was down almost to like 20, 25%. It's ticking back up a little because of all the AI startups that are getting unicorn valuations. We're willing to pay up in unusual circumstances. We have to see that there's a 5x for us in the growth fund and a 10x in the early stage fund. And if you're investing at $2 billion, and you're looking for a 5x, you need to have a pretty big company valuation at the exit. And so we're a little bit cautious there, but we're doing it. I mean, we invested in Perplexity at $9 billion, which was kind of crazy in some ways. On the other hand, if it works, it's going to be worth a couple hundred billion. So we can see that being the trend. So we do it, but we're very cautious at the very inflated valuations. I much prefer a $30 million seed round with a new founder who we think has the ability to really grow, than a $300 million round at $5 billion. But we're seeing both in the valley. Outside the valley, we're seeing much better pricing, and we're seeing AI being done all over the world.
Knowing that, arguably AI is complex, but it's also evolving quick. As you're doing your due diligence, do you find the firm will put more weight on the founder than the technology, or vice versa?
Well, people always say the most important thing is the founder and the people. In fact, if you look through history, the most important thing is how big is the market they're going after. But right after that is the founder. So we put more weight on the founder. We know that whatever product we're seeing is not going to be a product in a year. Product's going to evolve. So we need a founder who can help make the products evolve. But we want to make sure they're evolving into a market that's big enough to provide really large revenue streams, regardless of how you manipulate or move around a little bit in it. If you have an amazing founder and a niche market, a really small niche market, even if you get it all, you're not going to get giant venture returns. So there's that combination of how big's the market, how good's the founder, and then where are they either applying or furthering AI technology.
I'm curious, on average, how many investments will you make a year out of the $400 million fund?
Out of the $400 million fund, we'll typically do 10 to 12 investments a year. That fund should have 50 or 55 at most, but more like 50 investments. And that'll probably be over 40 months. It's 48, 36, 42 months, something like that. So about an investment a month.
Got it. If we could take a step back, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, and you're aware the MDC recognized you for an illustrious career, would love to hear what that looked like leading up to your role as chairman.
Sure. I mean, the career arc was I started out being very lucky to be advised when I was in college not to go into big physics, high energy physics, but to go into computing. And this was in 1968, before most people knew much about computing. And when you're early, all the problems are easy. There's a lot of low hanging fruit. So I became a professor at Cornell University for a few years and at Caltech, and then 12 years at the University of Pennsylvania, where I was jointly tenured in the Wharton School and the Engineering School, the Moore School of Engineering. So I was kind of an unusual player who understood that computers were important and applying them to business was really important. And that led to Jim Simons asking me to help found Renaissance Technologies with him back in 1982. So I left for a 2-year leave of absence, never came back, to start Renaissance with Jim. He was the CEO, I was the president. And in the first 7 years of Renaissance, which is now known as the premier quant trading fund around the world, but the first 7 years, we also had about half the money in venture. And for the first 5 years, venture dominated the returns. It was only in years 6 and 7 that we got the quant models working well enough that we took the venture out of Renaissance in 1989 and let it become the quant fund it is today. And I continued to invest from the same office and, with my money and Jim's in venture throughout the 90s, and doing things like Idea Lab with Bill Gross and a company called Infinautics with Josh Koppelman and Marvin Weinberger. And Josh later on did Half.com. And after that was sold to eBay, Josh in 2004 came to me and said, he had moved back to the Philadelphia area. He said, I think it's time for an early stage, seed stage fund, and asked me to help start First Round Capital. So Josh and I started a firm called First Round Capital in 2004, early 05. That has done spectacularly well. It was the first organized seed fund. Fund one, which was the first 3 years, was a little complicated structurally, and did quite well. We went to do fund two. We went to Yale University and spoke with the late Dave Swenson. And he said, hey, I like you guys. I like the combination of youth and experience between me and Josh, but I can only put in $22 million and it's not going to move my needle because I've got a $15 billion endowment, but I'll do it anyway. So he put in $22 million and Princeton put in about the same and a few other places. We raised a $132 million fund. That fund returned 50x. So Princeton and Yale each got $1 billion back, actually moved their needles. They had to report on it. And that was the result of doing 70 investments in the fund. 68 returned about 5x, including Square and other things. The 69th was a firm rather, that started in our San Francisco office from a founder who we had backed earlier, made a lot of money with. And we said, whatever you're doing next, here's $250,000, here's a desk, just come to us when you're ready. And he did, and we gave him this desk, and we said, what are you doing? What are you starting? He said, well, I want to call black cars in San Francisco. I'm calling it Uber Cab. The San Francisco Taxi Authority said you couldn't use the word cab, so we shortened it. That was Uber. We invested day one. It was in our office for 6 months. Garrett Camp was the founder. A few months later, he brought in Travis Kalanick. And when it exited, Uber returned 22 times the whole fund. So did really, really quite something, which would have been enough for anybody. But about a month after the Uber decision, our partner Chris Fralick bought a company in the gaming space, which we turned down. And then a month after that, he came back to us and he said, look, I think you made a mistake. I'm bringing my 8-year-old son Max to pitch you on Roblox. And with Max's enthusiasm, we decided to do it. So we did Roblox, and that in the end returned even more than Uber, like 23, 24x. Yeah. And so, it was kind of an amazing fund. Funds three, four, five, et cetera. I think they're up to fund nine now. Did quite well. When we started First Round, I said to Josh, I would give him 10 years. I was 60 when we started. 10 years later, I said, it's you're going to need new fresh blood. It's early stage funds need to rejuvenate. So I'm going to step back. I announced I was stepping back. And that's when Raj and Eduardo approached me and said, look, we're starting something, but it's not going to compete with First Round. It's going to be B stage and later global, which First Round wasn't. And we have this partnership with BCG. And I said, sounds exciting. Count me in as an investor. How big a commitment can I make? And they said, no, we want you to be our chair and help us make new mistakes, but not repeat the ones you've already made, building Renaissance and Idea Lab and First Round and so on. And so I joined officially on one third of my time. If you ask my wife, she said that means 8 hours a day, but with B Capital. And I spend my time both overall firm operations and strategies and a chunk of it running the Ascent Fund, the early stage fund.
Well, congratulations to an amazing career. I probably can count myself around the rest of our audience who thinks if only we're so fortunate. And you know, I have a bunch of questions. Let me start. Was there a defining moment back in the UPenn days when you realized that the impact computers were going to have on business?
I would say that in 1973, I brought number, machine 50 on the ARPANET to the University of Pennsylvania. So this internet was, the information superhighway. We were hacking it out of the brush, if you will. And I got on email. So I've now got 52 years of email, received the first spam ever sent in 1974, and receive a lot more of it today, I would say. And I realized pretty quickly that this was going to change the world. And I would say that between 1973 and 1979, when I was doing a lot of research on what we called in those days the Office of the Future, which I would go around lecturing the world's big companies and governments saying, you're going to be on email, you're going to have word processing. I spent 1977 teaching at the Harvard Business School. One of my students, Dan Bricklin, created VisiCalc, which was the spreadsheet at the time. And I guess I and we had done for my Office of Naval Research projects and DARPA windowing systems long before Microsoft Windows. And I said, I can see how this is going. This is going to spread to basically everyone. And I kind of could predict and did predict, I would say, everything that happened up until the iPhone. So in terms of the internet and business, I foresaw that. I have articles about it. And I could see what was going to happen. And as a result, even when I was at Penn, I made a few investments in various technology companies, and it was kind of interesting. One of them was one that Jim Simons and I invested in somebody from the RAND Corporation, a company called Interactive Systems. It was the first Unix licensee of Bell Labs, the first commercial license for Unix. It led to the Unix that Sun uses, that IBM used. And a whole bunch of different Unix systems got bought eventually by Sun. And that's why Jim then invited me to join him in starting Renaissance and doing venture capital out of there. But that time at Penn, pretty much 73 to 76, is when I started realizing this was really world-changing.
You know, I'm curious if you've ever done a comparison between the rate of technology adoption between the early 70s and, the late 90s, mid 90s, when the internet finally started to take off as compared today, and what you attribute the differences to.
So in 93, we had a company called Quarterdeck Office Systems put out the first browser and put out the first video chat and all those things. And doing all that on 56K dial-up modems just didn't quite work. And the internet in 1999 had roughly 100 million users, mostly using dial-up. Okay. And so what's, and it was still pretty explosive. But what really changed it, and that's kind of when Google started. We had Idea Lab had GoTo, which was the first big search engine, became called Overture, ended up in Microsoft's hands. Google ended up paying hundreds of millions for our patents on paid search. Bill Gross announced paid search at the TED conference and was booed. People were like, "Oh, people are going to pay for my time and my attention in search. No, that's horrible." Including Larry and Sergey saying, "This is terrible. We'll never do that." Until they realized it was an amazing business model, and they did it. They're good guys, and I like them a lot. And we sold them Picasa later on for their photo stuff. But I would say that, we did realize what was going to happen with this. And what changed was in the early 2000s, after all the fiber was laid and all the bankruptcies of the fiber companies, we had the ability to create cheap broadband everywhere. And we went from 100 million users to a couple of billion users on broadband. And that just changed everything. And then, as I said, the iPhone then changed everything after that.
So, said another way, the silver lining on the dot-com bust was the infrastructure it left in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the same thing happened during the railroad generation with all the bust on the infrastructure. But it is what changed the world because it made broadband possible and feasible. And what the iPhone did was made the whole thing accessible to consumers everywhere, particularly outside the US.
I'm curious, when you look at the world today, what are the infrastructure rate limiting steps that have your attention?
Power. I mean, AI needs power. AI is hungry for power. And the rate limiter for AI is going to be how much electricity generation can we build? And you're hearing, I mean, in today's New York Times, Tom Friedman has an editorial about it. Certainly, if you people who listen to Ellen podcast can hear Dave Friedberg, who I had backed one of his early companies, talking about it. We are not building power in the US nearly fast enough compared to what China's been doing. And if you want AI, you need power.
Are you surprised then that there aren't more incentives, whether at the federal or state level, to bring?
There were incentives and they've been cut out of the big, beautiful bill. Am I surprised? Yeah, I mean, I think it's short-sighted. I do think nuclear is going to be a big help over the next decade, but nuclear takes 5 years to build, even if the permitting is eased. We haven't seen a lot of evidence of that yet. We're starting to see a little bit, maybe. Killing all the grants for solar and wind and alternative energy sources, which actually are built much faster and provide energy onto the grid much faster than big nuclear plants and other things. It's kind of dumb, but it'll be what it'll be. And I'm a believer that our capitalist system will create the incentives and people will keep trying. But we're definitely shooting ourselves in the foot right now.
I agree, and I also agree with your assessment that God bless entrepreneurs. They'll figure it out. I'd love to come back to your time at Renaissance. You mentioned it, but I'll put some emphasis on it for the benefit of our audience who perhaps not as familiar with the hedge fund world. So, as you pointed out, one of the most successful quant training funds ever. And so I have limited familiarity with Jim. He was a mathematician by trade. I want to say one of the state universities, if you said the name.
Stony Brook.
My book, thank you. I'm curious, it's interesting. I think of a dichotomy as a pure quant method to investing as compared to early stage venture, where there's an emphasis on the founder. How did your experience with those two influence how you looked at the world, later on in your venture career?
Well, I think both Jim and I were very focused on modeling numbers and on understanding numbers and on how they could be used predictively. Obviously, in the quant trading world, you're predicting short-term movements very quickly. But what we learned in the quant trading world was it's all about data. Whoever has the most data wins. And Renaissance, even today, has 50 years of data, tick-by-tick data to do research on. No one else has that. That's why they're still doing so well even today. And what we learned in venture is the more data you have about each company and about the market they're in, the better you're going to do, the better decisions you're going to make. So I think there's a lot of crossover in what I learned. Obviously, the people part's very important, but at Renaissance, that translated into who did Jim hire, what kind of mathematicians. So he never hired anyone who knew anything about the markets. Because he was hiring mathematicians, statisticians, physicists, astrophysicists, people who understood time series, number series, big data. And he didn't want them to be colored by thinking they knew something about what that data was about. So the fundamentals of a company kind of, they didn't want to know about that unless it was in the data. which is, you know, their earnings and other data, but it's all about the data. Now, that was true of all the people researching and creating trading signals. There's another group that did the actual trading on the markets, and the markets are brutal in terms of actual trading. So that group gets credit for figuring out how to make a trade at the right price against people who are trying to front run them or do other things to cut their profitability. And so there are two separate groups there. One group is kept pure, if you will, in terms of coming up with trading signals using all of the best techniques of the day, whether it's statistical techniques or AI techniques, whatever they are. How do we take a large amount of data? And Jim once said to me, if somebody comes to me with a much better algorithm for trading, and another guy comes to me with a new source of data no one else has, I'd much rather pay for the data. You know, we'll figure out the algorithms.
Interesting. So, you know, so what I hear is that given your success or renaissance of success, there's, you know, a degree of predictability when you can appropriately manage the downside or entry as exits on your trades. You know, and then my thoughts immediately go to, well, is there predictability in founder profiles? You know, is there predictability in, you know, a certain set of circumstances that you'll have a higher probability of success with the Ubers of the world. Did you find any translation?
Well, we did. I mean, first round did a 10-year study and showed what factors led to higher market value, higher results. We have 12 people in Singapore on the AI team that Eduardo was leading. SignalFire is out there. There are a couple of quantitatively managed venture funds. There's a lot of signal to noise. There's a lot of signal in the noise. And with the founder, the signal has to do with all sorts of things. So we have an AI algorithm to actually rate the founding teams. And it's based on their experience, their education, and, you know, were they successful or not? How close to what they've studied are they working? You know, if you have a founder who's been an amazing founder at Uber, for example, in transportation, and they want to start something that has nothing to do with transportation, that may not translate as well. So, you know, how close to what they want to do next is what they've done in the past. So, yeah, there's a lot you can do in a quantitative way. I don't think you can make the whole decision that way because integrity is very critical. You want to have founders who will tell you the truth, including the bad news. You want to have founders who are fun to work with because you're going to work with them for a decade after you make the investment, and life's too short, right? So you want to be able to somehow assess those things independently, but there are a lot of quantitative measures that we're finding and we're using.
Makes complete sense. And it's really fascinating to hear hear you say that they complement one another. You know, just by sheer background, started my career day trading during the dot-com boom. I happened to work in a small RIA, and they had a hedge fund. I think I could say the name. It's been over 20 years. Caxton out of Princeton.
Sure. Bruce.
Yeah, Bruce Kovner. And you know, I knew he was employing a bunch of PhD mathematicians, and I was watching them short stocks to zero and consistently. And I asked the question, you know, how do you do that? And so I've always kind of been fascinated by this idea that there are patterns,
Yep.
how you apply them in the venture world. So that's great to hear. So now you spent, it sounds like, over 2 decades effectively immersed in venture. How have you seen it change over the years, and has it been for the better or for the worse?
Well, like anything else, success brings in a lot of competitors, right? When we started first round in 2005, we were the only seed stage fund, pretty much. By 2010, we showed our investors at the annual meeting a slide that had, here are 12 new seed stage funds starting with the letter F this year. So what happens is there's a basic law of economics, supply and demand. So if the supply of capital gets too big, right? The prices are going to get out of range. And so what happened was in 2005, I think our average entry pre-money valuation was in the 2 million range. And a couple of years later, it gotten to 3, and then it got to 5 and 6. And the exits did not continue to increase. And that's the same pattern we're seeing today, really, which is that, the entry prices have gone up way faster than exit prices, which means that returns are going to come down. Josh Koppelman, my co-founder at First Round, an amazing both entrepreneur and venture capitalist, had a really good podcast a few weeks ago about the venture math for the industry, and it doesn't bode well. There's too many venture funds, and it's kind of like when in 1982, when Jim and I started investing in the PC world, we had 300 companies come to us saying, we're going to have 1% of the PC market, Compaq and all those come. And well, that's 300%. That doesn't work. You can't all have 1% of the market. Plus, that's not the way competition works. One of you's got to get 50% for it to be interesting. So I think we're seeing that in the venture world today. Way too many funds, way too many solo GPs, which is I don't know what the right word is, an unnerving trend, because as an investor, because on the other side, I have a family office, we're investors in 80 VC funds, and we worry about solo funds because there's nobody to check, to try to check and balance for that solo founder's thinking. And so, yes, if they hit one big, great. But there's nobody to temper their craziness, however it may be. So I much prefer funds that have multiple players and investment committees and a little bit of structure.
So do you see consolidation in venture, or do you just see these funds close up shop because these are you're growing impatient?
Well, after the bubble, I don't know the exact numbers, but there were 1,500 venture funds that the bubble started. There were 800 a year later. NVCA can give you the statistics, but a huge number of firms closed up shop. They returned almost zero. There were funds that returned close to zero. They got their money in 99 and invested it all in 12 months. And the crash happened, and basically most of their companies went away. I worry about that right now in the AI world. Particularly for some of these solo GP funds who are investing in some of these big AI things. There is a difference, which is that today, at least, because of secondary markets, you don't have to wait for the IPO or the merger. You can get out of some of your stock. And at B Capital, we've taken advantage of that when it's appropriate. It's the right thing to do. And so that added a new exit vehicle. But your net, it's going to cut off the long tail. And if you look at the Ubers and the Robloxes and so on, it's that long tail where you make the giant returns. And so if you keep squashing it down, then the overall industry returns are there's no question they're going down.
I'm curious, do you have any exit markers that the firm will use to make a decision that it's time to get some return off the table with a secondary?
We do. We have a small team actually that looks at when it's appropriate to exit. We don't have any specific marker, but first of all, it has to, if it's beating our base case, where we thought it would be in that many years by a significant amount, we might take 20% off the table. We might take our bait off the table, as it were. There's nothing that LPs like better than DPI, than getting dollars returned to them. And it's great to have a fund that has a TVPI, a total value of 3, 4, 5. But if the DPI is 0.1, it's not. It's, it ain't, Josh used to say, it ain't real until the mullah's in the kula. And so you really do have to get those some real exit. And that exit can easily be secondary sales. In today's market, that's perfectly legitimate. Usually don't sell all of it. You keep some of it.
Howard, I genuinely appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing it with our audience. Before we wrap up, two more questions. One's a retrospective. I really enjoy asking our guests, and that is, if you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
Well, I would have told my younger self that making the decision to give up a fellowship to MIT in physics and go into computing instead in 1968 was the right decision. But I probably would have learned more about molecular biology, because I think the revolution in DNA genetics, all that, is something that used a lot of mathematics, a lot of pattern recognition skills. So I might have told myself to learn more about that. And what I tell kids today who say, "Where, where should I be?" And you can't just say AI; that doesn't really do it. I think the major impacts on humanity are going to come from the biological sciences over the next 2 decades. And I think that's a crucial area, along with space and robots. I mean, we've invested in Apptronik in Texas, humanoid robotics, and Google's been a co-investor with us. Elon Musk has said he thinks there'll be billions of humanoids. I agree with him on that. I don't agree with him on a lot of things, but that one I do agree. So there's a lot of exciting things happening in the world to invest in over the next couple of decades.
Only because you mentioned it, I'm curious. I've also given thought to the impact that biotechnology advances will have on longevity. And one of the consequences that I see is that there's an asset liability mismatch. People just aren't anticipating living, 90, 100, maybe even longer. Curious whether or not you've considered that. And if so, have you started making any investments along those lines?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, my father, a major influence in my life, had his finances all set after he sold his business when he was 75 to be able to fund his life till he was 88. He lived to 93. So fortunately, I was there to help cover that last 5 years. But you're absolutely right. People do not plan properly for that. I've been on a major mission for the last 7 years on longevity, on personal longevity. And then doing some investing around that to try to do things that will help me live a longer, healthier life, and with the health span, as we call it now, which is to say, I don't want to be on tubes till I'm 120. But if I'd like to be walking around, my friend Alan Patrickoff, who's 91, says he's going to live to 114. He's completely sharp today. I'm trying for 120. I don't know if I'll get there. But we're doing whatever we can, more better sleep, better diet, better exercise, whatever you can do supplement wise and medicine medically, lots of things happening. That space is exploding. Peter Diamandis, Peter Attia, Dr. Florence Comite, my doctor, it's explosive, and I think it's important. But it's not clear in the venture space how to invest in it, because the government doesn't quite know how to regulate it. The FDA does not recognize aging as a disease, so which means that you can't have an aging medicine because it's not a disease. Therefore, we doesn't need medicine. Well, we know that's not true inherently, but so there's a lot to do before we get to making it easily investable.
Excited to keep our eye on it. Last but not least, I'd love to give you an opportunity to recognize anyone personally or professionally in your life who's had a material impact.
So I'm working on my memoir, which is called Pick Great Partners. And I will name a few of them. My wife, Eleanor, 57 years so far, hopefully a lot longer, supportive and all the way through. Jim Simon, well, my thesis advisor who passed away, Dick Conway, but Jim Simons, major influence in my life, was a big loss to the world a couple of years ago when he died. And but the Simons Foundation continues to be the largest supporter of mathematics and astrophysics and so on around the world. So still doing great there. Bill Gross at Idea Lab continues to come up with great new ideas. Josh Koppelman is the best venture capitalist I know, and a really thoughtful and wonderful person, and was an absolutely great person to start first round with. And my current partner is Raj and Eduardo. And I view myself as a catalyst. So they all do the work, and I throw my 2 cents in here and there and nudge them a little bit, maybe this direction, that direction, to make things a little better. But great partners are really important in this world, and I've been very fortunate.
Well, shout out to all of them. Congratulations on 57 years of marriage. That's fantastic. Great example for the rest of us. And when do you anticipate the memoir coming out?
Oh, I think it's 2 years out. But these I've written books before. They take a long time.
Well, we'll make a point of calling it out in the show notes and see if we
And
can't go for ourselves.
I'm not letting ChatGPT write it. I actually have to write it myself.
Well, Howard, thank you again. I genuinely appreciate your time. If are there anyone in our audience who'd like to learn more about B Capital, where should they go?
Well, b.capital is our website, and that tells a lot. If they want to connect with me, Howard at b.capital, I can, depending on what they say in the message, I might respond, or I might not put it on. Somebody will get a response.
Fantastic. Again, for the benefit of our audience, Howard Morgan, Chairman at B Capital Group. Howard, thank you so much. This was a fantastic and insightful podcast. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Christian.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.